You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits, brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment,
to transport and planning and housing issues,
to privatisations and our utility services,
to building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Okay, tar and cement and city limits, and I'll tell you what, riding over the tar and cement this morning was pretty cold. And Timothy's over there, I'm Kevin Healy. And there's the clink of cups. Timothy, I'm going to pour you a cup of tea. We've already got drinks in front of us. You've given me this wonderful, what's it actually called? Is it coffee something or other?
I got Kevin an iced matcha this morning.
Ah, right, yes. Well, anyway, it's very nice. But we're going to have tea as well. The tea itself is actually a Vietnamese green tea this morning. Now, we've got a yellow cup and a grey and something or other cup.
I'll have the yellow cup, please.
Okay, you don't get a handle on yours. It's a handleless cup.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't have a handle on anything these days.
Okay, that's fair enough, yes, like most of us. And today, being a fifth Wednesday, we're going to be talking, not because it's a fifth Wednesday, but because it gives us a chance to talk to Dave Sweeney, from the anti-nuclear campaigner at ACF. Well, he's actually just finished that job fairly recently, but he's still involved in the issue. In fact, I'm not sure what his title currently is, but we'll find out. But Dave Sweeney's going to talk to us about the latest developments, the uranium to India, and of course other things happening around, another number of things happening around the whole issue of AUKUS and uranium and the ALP. He was in Adelaide the weekend at a peace conference, and he'll also talk to us comparing the peace conference to what else was happening in Adelaide with the ALP, and which was less of a peace conference, I would have thought. He's going to talk about all those things to us this morning. We're also going to pay a small tribute to Bevan Ramsden, great peace campaigner who died on Monday. And Bevan was actually at the conference that I think he in fact chaired a session that Dave was involved in on Sunday. And while still in Adelaide on Monday, he just had a heart attack. And Bevan goes back to my generation of coming out of that anti-Vietnam movement. And he's been a peace activist all his life, right up to the end. So
right, that sounds very sudden.
Yeah, it was very sudden. And anyway, Dave knew him much better than I did in recent times, and I think we'll pay some sort of tribute to him at, when he comes on. So there we are.
But what are we starting with this morning?
I don't think we need to talk about the change of leadership in Victoria, because I think everyone knows what it means. It means we're going even further backwards than we were before.
Well, everyone's been up until 2 a.m. reading about it, I'm sure. So
I'm sure they have. That's right, yes. But the media seem to think it's pretty important. But I think my only comment on Ben Carroll would be to quote Shakespeare and leave it at that and say that ambition should be made of sterner stuff, and just leave it at that, I think. He's certainly got ambition, but I don't know if he's got the sterner stuff. He might stub up the state, that's all. And he's already, of course, decided to sell out the workers. Anyway, we'll just leave it at that. However, some workers do it tough. And Antimony, I know you're going to find this a bit of a shock, but Pauline Hanson says, who do you think she says did it tough?
I would say she thinks that she herself has done it tough.
Yes, I'm sure she does. But she thinks that Gina Rinehart did it tough. That's why she admires her.
Mm. because she's only got one plinth with poetry on it in a public square.
Dragged herself up from the from her mother's womb with her father's wealth, but that's so she did it tough. That's right. So anyway, I thought you'd be pleased to know that it's a headline. She did it tough. Hansen defends her relationship with Reinhardt. So there you are.
Money is very heavy. It's a real burden to carry around. Imagine those pockets full of dollars.
That's right.
How difficult that must be.
Poor, tough Gina. But it does get worse for working people because Albanese announced one of the few positives to come out of the ALP conference, looking at establishing a new fair work court. Now, the Industrial Relations Court was abolished in 1997 by the Howard government at the behest of the employers, who are now screaming. And this is one that will, even though we've got the Fair Work, which we call it Fair Work Tribunal, Aussie No Longer Work Choices, just looks like a commission. It can't deal with some of the small things and unfair dismissals, and it also can't impose penalties. It can't even hear those cases. But he's going to appoint industrial relations judges to it. But the employers are screaming their heads off, of course. And Innes Willocks is always screaming his head off from the Australian Industry Profits Group, Industry Group. He says, industry will be understandably dubious about who will be appointed to the new court. Given unions have pushed for this development, there will be unsurprising scepticism about the prospect of it operating in an entirely balanced manner. And yesterday there was another article by an industrial relations boss's person saying that this is going to even complicate industrial relations even more and set it back even further, and because workers are going to have a right to go to court and have their cases heard, which is pretty terrible. And this, of course, comes on top of the fact that there's an article saying on the front page of the Financial Review last week, a couple of days earlier, saying standard of living worst in a century. But nonetheless, if workers were to say they want to improve their standard of living by having a wage rise, well, that would be a disaster for the economy. Mm. And this morning in the Financial Review, I was just looking at briefly a moment ago, and here we have Michelle Bullock from the Reserve Bank. Again, Bullock sounds alarm, and she says living standards will continue to stagnate until the fundamental challenge of weak productivity growth is addressed. So the workers have to pull their fingers out.
They're just not trying hard enough.
They're just, bludgers, absolute bludgers. Now, one item, though, that is quite concerning. Last week, I'm going to have a sip of this this cold drink.
I'll go for it.
That was me having a sip of a cold drink for those who enjoyed that wonderful bit of radio. I don't think that Ben Carroll being Premier is going to change this either, but there's been reports in the last week or so that the Victorian government is considering privatising Melbourne Water. Now, there's a technical problem there. They can't actually give full privatisation. It's restricted under the Constitution, but they can do all sorts of things like, 90-year leases and all that sort of rubbish.
And they say politicians can't think long-term.
No, they can't think long-term. Of course they can't. And the problem is, of course, that overseas there's been some pretty tragic results of water, particularly in Britain, where, of course, they've had massive problems. The privatisation of water in England in 1989 and in Wales is regarded as a controversial experiment that led to higher bills and crumbling infrastructure. Thames Water, the UK's largest water supplier, is facing collapse and a government bailout due to its unmanageable debts. And there's been also, lots well, they've all run into massive amounts of trouble. Macquarie Bank is involved, Australia's Macquarie Bank is involved in ownership of some of them, and they've been proved to be pure disasters, and of course they're now looking to the government to come and bail them out. And there's been some water people who just don't get water at all, or it's contaminated.
Literally bailed them out.
Here we are talking about it. It's interesting, though, that one article in the Financial Review says, still any move to unlock some of the billions of dollars held within Melbourne Water would be a big move for the Allen government, given Labor's well-known aversion to selling off public assets. But then it goes on to point out that they've already sold off ports, roads and registries, Vic Roads, motor registration bit, the titles registry, the Port of Melbourne was leased out, which doesn't actually show much of an aversion to selling off public assets, I would have thought.
But, I just want to point out that the billions of dollars in the water is from people throwing their coins into the water, and if we take them all out, that means children's wishes won't come true.
Won't come true. Little fairies are too as well. It's awful.
Yeah, that's
awful.
Right.
That's right.
Those 5 cent coins have to stay in the fountains.
Exactly. So, Melbourne Water reported $2.1 billion in revenue in the last 12 months and an $81.7 million profit. Now, I would have thought whatever you do, it's worth hanging on to that profit in public hands rather than flogging it off on the basis that the government is in trouble. But anyway, there's a fair bit of talk about it at the moment, and it's worth keeping an eye on, because it would be, I think, not only a disaster in terms of losing that income to the state, but also I think it would end up seeing, as usual with privatisation, deterioration of service and an increase in costs, which in what we pay for it. But ironically, the state shadow person, never heard of it before, a woman called Jade Benham, is the opposition water spokeswoman here in Victoria. And she said Victorians deserve to know exactly why the Allen government is planning for Melbourne and what it's planning. And they deserve to know now, not after a deal is already done behind closed doors. This is a government that has proven time and again it cannot manage the basics. Victorians have a right to be asking what any change in Melbourne Water will mean for water bills, etc. And yet this is the same Liberal government, of course, that under Kennett, that privatised gas, electricity and all sorts of things. So
anything that wasn't nailed down.
Quite interesting.
I like to think of water as its own profit, really.
Yes, that's right. And, it is. And we had, of course, last week we had Helen Vandenberg on talking about the fact that in New Zealand and even in Australia, in Victoria now, water is to be treated under the law as an entity of its own and has rights to be protected. And I don't think giving it off to the private sector would protect it. But, of course, one of the private sector people, a bloke called Nick Kelly, portfolio manager for WAM Alternative Assets, it sounded like a wonderful company, said water was one of the best diversifying assets an investor could hold within a broad portfolio. There's never been a better time for a government to sell a water asset, he said. In other words, he wants to make a killing out of it.
Well, he can just get it out of the tap like the rest of us.
He could. Just turn on the tap, that's right. And although if it gets privatised, turn on the tap, it mightn't come out anymore. So that's another problem.
Just pure profits coming out.
Yes.
Hot and cold profits.
Profits, that's it. Now, of course, we know that that giant mine, the American Secretary for War, Pete Hegseth, wants to hit the soldiers, the trained killers, American trained killers, with more testosterone to make them even bigger trained killers.
I've got so many opinions about this,
yes,
Kevin.
Yes, have you? Okay, he wants them, he says it'll reshape the military around a warrior ethos, rolling back diversity initiatives, which, you know, as we know about, emphasising traditional masculinity, combat fitness and physical appearance. But the bit I like is, adequate testosterone levels would make soldiers strong, resilient and capable, keeping them on the, quote, leading edge of lethality that makes them more lethal. They can kill more people. An extraordinary performance, even by his standards, the old Pete. But I think at least it's fair enough, though, because he does, you know, I think that's one thing they're being honest about. He, you know, instead of being Secretary of Defence, he's actually Secretary of War, and I think that's much more appropriate in the circumstances. Whereas here, Richard Miles is Minister for Defence when he should be Minister for Offence and Trained Killing and all that sort of thing, and he's desperately trying to build up. But you said you had some views on it.
I've got so many views, but we don't have 3 hours. We've only got 45 minutes left, and we do need to talk to Dave at some point.
That's right, we do.
In another life, I work for the Endocrinologist Society of Australia as a freelance writer, and so I talk to a lot of people about testosterone all the time. Testosterone is a bit of a hot topic right now in endocrinology and also in people with a body, if you know any of those. And I don't know if you've been on the internet lately, but testosterone's...
No, I have not.
Oh, good. This is how you're keeping the rest of your hair. But testosterone's a bit of a topic on there too. And it's just the equation of testosterone levels with manliness levels. Like, the higher your testosterone, the more of a man you are, and therefore, I guess, the higher lethality you are, because men, testosterone, and killing ability are all the same thing, I guess. And you can just test them all in a blood test. And if your testosterone is 10, that means you're a manly man and a superior killer, I suppose. But I wonder what this means for the low testosterone people of the military, which are sometimes known as women. What's going to happen when they get their testosterone levels checked and they find out that they're not a manly man at the highest levels of killingness?
I think that's where the... The bit about diversity comes in, isn't it? I mean, he gets rid of them altogether because they're not diverse at all. They're too diverse or something. But there's also been, you know, I have been reading lots of articles where in terms of what he's talking about, it's absolute crap anyway.
Yeah. The thing about testosterone is that if you take it as a medication, if you put it into your body, then if you do it for long enough, then your body stops making its own testosterone and you become dependent on the medication. You stop having the ability to make your own sperm. Mm. It causes infertility and it causes systemic issues.
Yeah, all that. I've been reading articles about that, and it can lead to major health problems. Exactly as well. And all it's similar to peptides. There's currently a big move. You know, people taking peptides, and again, there's articles that say that, you know, that is all absolute crap as well. And yet, staying in America, this is also happening. It's while Trump and everyone else are getting noticed, Robert Kennedy, the health minister, who we know is brilliant, he's got a group called Make America Healthy Again, MAHA. Mm-hmm. And they're, it turns out they're pushing peptides and lots of things, but it's just... The interesting thing is that the board of MAHA is made up of mainly people who make profit out of flogging things to people, which may or may not be good for them. But also, for instance, Trump's son is involved in one of the companies that's made big money out of changes they've made to the Drug Administration. And there's lots of friends of Trump and co, and Kennedy himself, who are making fortunes out of changing some of the medical situations in America that allow certain things to be sold off and put on the market, which are quite questionable in terms of their health benefits anyway. So that's sort of happening behind the scenes as Trump goes ahead. Kennedy's going ahead also making fortunes for people with quite dubious approvals of various things, peptides being one of them.
Yeah, I mean, we all want to be beautiful and healthy forever. And I thought that this would happen when the millennials got old enough, that there would be like a worldwide freak out about the fact that bodies get aged. But I didn't really expect it to happen like this. I just thought we would all start going for runs or something.
Well, I've decided I'm going to do something about it. I do watch telly, and there's so many ads on television for things that can reduce your years. You know, you put this cream on, or you take something else, mm-hmm. and you can look so much younger and be so much younger. Mm. And I've done a calculation. If I went out and bought everyone they're advertising, this is true. I'm going to try it. If you go out and buy everyone they're advertising and take them and put them on my skin and everything else, I think within about 3 weeks I could be back in the womb.
I'm sure your mum would be surprised by that.
Yeah, she would. But nonetheless, that's a big chance. So I'm going to give it a try and see how I go, yeah.
Live on air, people.
Yeah, and there's a new dollar coin coming out in America, dollar gold coin with Donald Trump's face on it. Which defeats the purpose, because there was an 1886 law that enshrined a tradition that only deceased people could appear on American currency.
Okay. Well, now, let's start a new conspiracy theory.
In one level, that's promising if his head's on it, but unfortunately, he is still alive. And God We Trust is sitting up next to him on the coin. And he's also going to be signing American notes, which again is against the tradition, but... this is Donald Trump, isn't it?
But laws are optional in America these days.
Yeah. There was speculation that speech he made a couple of weeks ago about, you know, he's now proved that China interfered in the 2020 election and mm-hmm. all the crap. Mm-hmm. The speculation is that he's building up to declaring some sort of state of emergency in which he can interfere with the November elections for this year, where his lot are likely to go down. And if the Democrats get control, then he'll be back in trouble again, because there'll be probably impeachment and all sorts of things going on. So he'll either try to call off the elections under an emergency or rig them to the point where they're meaningless. So that's another build-up. But I thought the best description of Trump came... in an article by a bloke called John Carroll, who's a professor emeritus of sociology at La Trobe. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't agree with everything he says in this article, but at this part I really do. He says, a radical decline in civic political culture has followed the rise of Donald Trump to become America's president. In the United States, the functions of monarch and prime minister are concentrated in one person, meaning that an undignified president disturbs the political firmament far more seriously than would be the case in Britain or Australia. Trump, now this is the part I think really sums him up. Trump is brash and crudely xenophobic, a convicted felon. He has shown little faith in democracy or respect for the American Constitution. He lies shamelessly. He tars opponents with invented slanders. He is a blatant misogynist, and he installs in public office only those subservient to his erratic views. The Trump personality is vain, tempestuous, and vengeful. In short, the current president is the converse of a role model. Pretty much sums him up, I would have thought.
Yeah, the thing that gets me, I suppose, is that there's been so many think pieces like this, and there's been so many eloquent opinions read, that I'm actually getting bored of hearing all of this, because I know it already. I know that Trump is bad, and I know that he's bad in all ways.
That, yeah.
And so it sort of creates this sort of numbing effect where it becomes old news that this terrible thing is happening, and so it doesn't have, like, the shocking value anymore.
No,
because it just becomes kind of normal.
Well, it's just
because
him.
I'm used to hearing it.
That's right. It's just him, isn't it? Just what he is. And as we move on with AI taking over... and they keep telling us, so they won't be taking jobs at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mineral Resources, one of the biggest mining companies in the country, has told staff that it won't hire people unless the job cannot be done by artificial intelligence.
Okay, so humans as a last resort.
Yes, humans as a last resort.
Mm-hmm. We're doing robots, we're doing trained border collies, we're using five-year-olds,
right.
And then if none of those work, then we'll move to adult human workers.
That's right. Or we'll move up to, if Pauline one, we couldn't bring him and bring people in to do that work. That's pretty nasty.
No, we'd have to just outsource it remotely.
Yeah, it's pretty awful, isn't it? Pretty awful.
Mm. Or maybe she's got some more children that she can give a job to.
Yeah, and of course, we might talk to Dave about it. Well, one thing I do want to mention is that Penny Wong came out and said that the Hamas is the problem in terms of a two-state solution, and didn't mention anything about the fact that Israel might be playing a small role in getting in between a two-state solution and a two-state solution. I thought again, by saying Hamas is the sole problem, when in fact, the two-state solution is totally impossible, thanks to, well, Israel has already declared there'll never be a state of Palestine anyway. Mm. But no mention of that, just that Hamas is the problem. I just found that pretty much summing up Australia's position. And, of course, we saw it reflected in the ALP conference last weekend.
Mm. Well, I'm sure she's looked into it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
She seems smart. She's got glasses.
She's the expert, yeah. Well, she is smart. I mean, she's an intelligent woman, but she obviously refuses to, at least publicly, state the obvious, I would have thought, in this case.
Maybe they're just, like, building up.
Yeah, okay. Let's get Dave Sweeney in, because I'm sure he's got some thoughts on those things as well. He was in Adelaide, not for the ALP conference, but the peace conference, but I'm sure he'd like to reflect on both. So we'll get him after the break.
All right, let's have a chat.
Are you ready to get lost in science this National Science Week? We'll join the Lost in Science team for our annual Trivia Night extravaganza at the Birmingham Hotel. Hop, skip and a jump away from 3CR on the corner of Smith and Johnson Streets in Fitzroy. Presented by the Lost in Science team with new and old science questions across a range of topics, picture rounds, group activities and prizes big and small to be won by you and your team. At the Burmy, corner of Smith and Johnson Streets, Fitzroy. That date again, Monday 17th of August. To get your tickets, you can look up Lost in Science Trivia 2026 online or head to 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au. Get lost in science during National Science Week.
Dave Sweeney. Dave, I've realised your ex ACF emeritus or something now. What's your current title?
Good morning, Kevin, and hello. I am finishing after a long stint with ACF. I'm exiting ACF Friday. So my title is still Nuclear Free Campaigner, Australian Conservation Foundation, for three more days.
Oh, well, we got him just in time.
Yeah, pretty much. This is probably the last media thing I'll do, so saving the best till last for 3CR.
Yeah, okay. That's nice. You make us feel good that way, don't you? Dave, we will kick off, though, with, I mentioned at the start of the program, the death of Bevan Ramsden on Monday, and I know you were with him at the weekend and in Adelaide. Could you, I was saying he was part of my generation, the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War generation, and he kept up his fight for peace all those years, right up until the very end. In fact, of course, at a peace conference on Sunday with you, and maybe a few words about Bevan.
Yeah, thanks. And for those listeners who are hearing this for the first time in news, like, sympathy, because it is sad and it is sudden. And Bevan was born in Thornbury in 1939, so, like, in the shadow of World War II. And he emerged from that shadow, and I suppose he's, you could just say that he spent the rest of his life fighting against war and trying to build peace, and was a veteran activist and peace advocate. And like you say, he was very active in the Vietnam moratorium. He was a great believer in the power of education and information, a TAFE teacher, and one who really tried to shine the light on the often very hidden activities and
he was one of what were known as the Monash Group at that time in the Vietnam period, and he was part of that group. And
yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he, you know, and then more recently, and the time that I sort of more recently connected with him, he obviously had a massive role in the formation of 3CR. And I remember at the 50th birthday celebrations, there was that footage that was from, you know, near on 50 years ago, but could have been today, of Bevan and others very passionately and effectively and sharply batting back current affairs and news interviews about whether 3CR was a breeding ground of terrorism and racism and anti-Semitism. And, you know, like that same footage, nearly that same language could be used again today, which shows the sort of cyclical or continuing nature of these struggles and so many of the struggles that Bevan was engaged in. Kevin, like you say, on the weekend, he there was the Independent Peaceful and Australia Network, IPAN, had their national gathering in Adelaide, rather, to a counterbalance to the ALP National Conference. And Bevan hosted, was the moderator of a session on Sunday morning, which was a speed dating style session where about a dozen groups active in peace and anti-militarism work gave a little snapshot of their work, their ambitions, and what they think is working about their work. And it was a really great session. I thought at the start, this is, you know, could be a smozzle, it could be far too ambitious. Everyone was disciplined. Bevan kept us moving, kept the clock ticking. It was a really positive thing. And I was talking to him afterwards about the 50th anniversary of 3CR. He was expressing that he was sad he couldn't make it and the importance of CR and the importance of this struggle. And I was talking to other colleagues when I heard this news, and they said that he was ecstatic on Sunday night, that the conference had been so good, that there were young people coming through, that there was a spirit of unity, that people had put aside any sort of small divisions and had their eyes on the prize that Australia is under great risk of drifting into incredibly dangerous engagements with the US military. And that was Sunday night. And then Monday morning, he passed suddenly at his hotel in Adelaide. So like a life well lived, well engaged, and like a life where he's worked for peace. So Maui, you know, may he now rest in it.
Very sad, yeah. And of course, as you say, he was one of the early activists at 3CR, and he's been a regular in the last year or two on Jan Bartlett's Going Home program as well, Tuesday Home Time.
Jan speaks with him, and Alternative News, and many other sort of forms. Mm.
Yeah, yes, it's a very sad occasion, but he certainly was active, as you say, right up to the very last, which is wonderful in that sense. But of course, the things you were talking about, and you mentioned the ALP conference. One could compare, I suppose, a peace conference in Adelaide and the ALP conference, which seemed to be anything but.
Well, the ALP conference was peaceful in the sense that there was no division.
That's right. only in that sense, yeah.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, really. Like the ALP conference, like it was stage management and curation worthy of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it was, I was just there and watching. I was there prosecuting a few Nuclear 3 things and calling for signature on the Treaty for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons and a few other things. And I was thinking, you know, we've got at least nominally a left-wing prime minister or a left-wing foreign minister, the left in the majority in the caucus, a massive majority in the House of Representatives. You could introduce any legislation you wanted, it'd pass the House. And we've got a Senate that's supportive. Like if legislation was half decent, the Greens and Pocock would sing it through with Labor. So conditions have never been more conducive to really significant change and really significant address of major and growing problems, including, you know, climate emergency, poly crisis, the US threat of US and UK, particularly US nuclear weapons stationed here under AUKUS, all sorts of things which are not helpful and which are not the vision of Australia that we could be or what so many of us want this country to be. And the lack of appetite was really quite extraordinary. It was managerial. It was you know, real politic. It was quite transactional. And, you know, like the Prime Minister's there starting setting the tone with where We're a party of outcomes, not outrage. We're a party of progress, not protest. And it was all like time to grow up, folks. And it was just quite a sort of sense of like, oh my God, what a squandered opportunity. There has rarely been more division and uncertainty and fear in Australia. There's rarely been more risk of our role in the region to just becoming like cemented as a quarry and a base. And here is the opportunity, you know, with a mandate from people, like a massive mandate that rejected Dutton and his version of Trump light and domestic nuclear power. And you're just sort of not spending that capital. You're just sort of quietly sort of creeping along, hoping not to offend. I'm not sure what the logic is, but I know what the result is. It's a result that is this country's not as bold, not as brave, not as generous as it could be.
And indeed, Penny Wong, in the same week, talking about the situation in Palestine, again came out and just said, Hamas continues to damage the prospects of a two-state solution and reject Israel's right to exist, but no condemnation of Israel whatever in that comment. I mean, again, she's too bright not to know the truth, isn't she?
Yeah, well, you'd think so. It's a little bit like, and, you know, that's not to excuse any party for any excess, you know, like, let's be clear on that. But it's a little bit like, you know, the outrage over China firing ballistic missile into the Pacific, and rightly so. So there should be, like, get the hell out of there. But at the same time, America's doing it three times a year, you know, without a word. And that sort of, I think that sort of institutionalising double standards, or I think it's a convenience of not seeing. Like, and I see that in the nuclear world very often. Like, for example, in domestic nuclear power, Federal Labor's, you know, sensible. They realise that it's risky, expensive, there's far better alternatives, you don't have to worry about waste, and no one's worrying if a terrorist is going to blow up the wind farm. So they're good on domestic nuclear power. But on nuclear weapons, the head of the Defence Department, addressing Senate estimates last December, Kevin, was asked, what about nuclear weapons and our nuclear weapons allies? And the answer, after a fair bit of probing, and a fair bit of deflection, the answer came back and it was, we don't ask, they don't tell, and the government's comfortable with that. So this sort of selective ability to see, like talking about a rules-based order and uniform rights and obligations, but picking and choosing which uniform you listen to or you see.
Well, you're also seeing it with that very group we're talking about, the United States, who are saying that Iran can never have it, they want to bomb the hell out of them, and yet they're prepared to hand over the wherewithal to Saudi Arabia at the same time. I mean, there's an absolute cross-current there somewhere.
Oh, it's extraordinary, that one. Like, we went into a war to nominally stop a Middle Eastern nation developing nuclear weapons, and I'm very keen that no one develops nuclear weapons, but we went into a war to nominally stop a Middle Eastern nation developing them. A Middle Eastern nation, by the way, who A, were involved in an international process auspiced by the International Atomic Energy Agency about verification, and B, we had been told by the same person who launched the war that an earlier strike had absolutely catastrophically destroyed their nuclear capability. So we go into a war without resolution but with great impact, adverse impact, for that reason. And along the way, the same person who says this mustn't happen exactly does that, gives the keys not just to domestic nuclear technology but to uranium enrichment, the ability to enrich uranium to weapons grade, to the Saudis. Like, it is just a recipe for massive instability, and it's just such, like, you know, a massive contradiction. There's no coherence in this approach. It's pick and choose, make it up. It's the response of the day, and it is not the way to build a sense of certainty and cooperation and collaboration, which we need to in a complex and a fragile and a shared world. And it's just extraordinary. And we have a real role in Australia. Like, we are a significant influence in the world, and we should be using that at every opportunity to champion, like, causes of peace, dialogue, consistency, equity, you know, regional development, addressing human needs and meeting real security concerns, rather than picking and choosing the topics that we get outraged about while turning a blind eye to increasing engagement with very risky and very damaging military alliances.
Mm. Well, the same hypocrisy comes out in an article just this week by John Bolton, who's a well-known American warmonger, of course. But he says China's rapid progress is ending the bipolar nuclear era dominated by the Cold War US-USSR standoff. The advent of a tripolar nuclear world throws the bipolar era's strategic calculations out of the window, and he's bemoaning the fact that China's becoming a third tripolar nuclear, and this is more dangerous than just having two of them. Comment on that?
Well, it's extraordinary because, A, it's not news. Like, there's no news there. If that's your strategic advisor, like, a Year 10 student would be writing a sharper essay. There are nine declared nuclear weapon states. China's got a significant nuclear weapons capability, and it's increasing it. But it's not alone. Other nations are doing the same. We need to cap nuclear weapons and wind them back. There's no right hands for the wrong weapons. So to sort of suddenly say it's okay for Putin and Trump to be able to stare down the world, but not okay for anyone else. Now, I'm not advocating that it's okay for anyone else. It's not. But the reality is there has been that potential for a long time. The reality is it has not been a standoff between the East Bloc and the West. That's changed. That's dramatically changed. And there's also non-state actors. There's India and Pakistan. There's Israel. Like, there's a lot of variables in this mix. And so to, again, turn around and say, oh, it's all about China, and it was better when it was just the two idiots you could trust, like the USA and the USSR, those days are gone. It is more complex. It is scarier. It is riskier. There's the introduction of non-state actors, the introduction of AI, and the collapse of aging command and control systems. And it's like, John Bolton, if you really want to bring down a sense of security, wind down these weapons. Like, I look at that sort of thing, and it's like harking back. It's like it was the grand old days of mutually assured destruction, as if that was reassuring or fun or safe. We got through it, as Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, says, by sheer dumb luck. And he says that luck is not a policy, and luck runs out. And I couldn't agree more with that. That's an analysis we should listen to more than John Bolton.
Yeah, there were lots of stories around about the finger almost being on the button, of course. But if you, I mean, one would seem to be enough anyway, but they've all got thousands of the bloody things. If you did say, let's get rid of them altogether, how do you get rid of them, and what happens to the waste and everything else?
None of this is simple. It's absolutely complicated, and you're really right. You start by not making more. You wind it back. And whilst there are nine declared states and there are thousands, we're down from 75,000 to 12,000. Now, that doesn't mean that the world's usually safer, because the volumes of this stuff, it can finish life on Earth. No, there's no question whatsoever. That's not melodramatic. That is just absolutely understating a fact. So the important thing, though, to remember, and this is perhaps where Bolton's got a point, is that 90% of nuclear weapons are between those two states, the USA and the USSR. So you can concentrate on those two and rein them in. But you need to take every step that there's no further spilling out of this, which is things like, you do not give a nation like Saudi Arabia or any nation the ability to enrich uranium without oversight. You do not sign a new uranium deal with India, which is not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and does not separate between its civil and military nuclear facilities. There is not an effective functional separation between India's civil and military nuclear facilities. And Australia, with a big, you know, fanfare at Marvel Studio in Melbourne, Anthony Albanese and Narendra Modi just signed this big deal and say uranium is going to fuel the future. Now, those things are unsafe, unnecessary, deeply unhelpful, and we need to not do them. When you say about nuclear weapons, the Treaty on the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, it's now fully half the nations in the world are signed onto that. Nearly all the Pacific, nearly all of ASEAN, large swags of Africa and Central and South America, and North America and Europe are the gap there. China and the weapon states are the gap there. But half the nations in the world are formally signed up to a legal instrument that makes these weapons unlawful under international law and says wind them back. So we have to keep growing the pressure. And it's a little bit like there's a bunch of bullies, there's a couple of bullies who are running the schoolyard, and we can either be separate and hope that they don't pick on us, or we, as the smaller kids who aren't bullied, can gather together, like union principle, that's the foundation, gather together and find some strength in commonality and community, and bell the cat. And we bell the cat by saying that any nation that has a weapon that can take out life on Earth, all it was and all it ever will be, ended in the presence pretty much by one man of any nation and any colour or hue or creed, that's not on. And we're going to call that out for what it is, which is a terrorist weapon. And to threaten mass and indiscriminate destruction is a terrorist act, and it is unacceptable, it's illegal, it's immoral, it is just not on. And we call it out, and we wind it back, and we use our domestic processes to constrain, and we get and push people to sign this treaty and abide by this treaty. It's got good safeguards and verification provisions and mechanisms. Kevin, we could talk through that, but it'd take us far too long. But they're solid. They passed the test of a whole range of international experts, technical, legal, political. It's got good adoption and universality, and it's our best chance to get rid of our worst weapons. And so, like, what Australia should do is not provide nuclear bomb fuel to countries that have either nuclear weapons programs or no clear distinction. So then, like, scrap sales to the US, scrap them to the UK, France and India, scrap them to China. We've already halted them to Russia. You know, like, we shouldn't be fueling this stuff, and then we should be signing this treaty, and then we should be standing in solidarity with the people of this nation and in the Pacific who are still living with the damage of former test sites and nuclear explosion sites. And there's so many things, all of them modest, no single one enough, but collectively it builds a momentum. It builds a momentum. And if you think about it and you look back, like, less than 20 years ago, ICANN started in Melbourne to drive a treaty. Two decades later, half the world's nations, not civil society groups, national government, are signed up to that treaty and believe it and honour it, and will be gathering in New York this December to discuss how to get the other half on board. Now, that's not fast enough, but it is real growth, and it shows that things can change. And that's what we've got to just keep doing, because the alternative is we close our eyes and we cross our fingers we're comfortable with that.
The other half, including Australia, of course, but we're also seeing it's always reckless anyway, but the US is bombing near and around nuclear sites in Iran. I mean, this is quite dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's hugely dangerous. And Iran has also responded with drone attacks near a reactor in the UAE, and Russia has, there's routine attacks on the Zaporizhia, Europe's biggest nuclear power plant in Ukraine. And nuclear power is one of the many things that makes it so risky, so dangerous and so unacceptable. It is the most weaponized energy source. Nothing comes within a bull's roar of it. You blow up a refinery, it burns. There's carbon emissions, there's damage, et cetera, et cetera. You blow up a wind farm, that's a pity. You blow up a nuclear reactor, you've got Chernobyl and Fukushima writ large. They are pre-deployed targets, and they are hugely damaging. And as, you know, anyone knows, like, in war, one of the first things that the opponent does is attempt to cripple and take out civilian infrastructure or critical infrastructure, bridges, roads, dams, power plants. They want to damage the ability of the opponent to sustain the fight. And, you know, you switch off the power and that damages enormously. And so increasingly, war planners are looking at nuclear plants as legitimate targets. And yet that would release vast, uncontrolled amounts of radiation, which doesn't respect borders. It's a massive threat, and it's becoming normalised, as is talk of using nuclear weapons. Israel's threatened it, US has threatened it, and Russia's threatened it in the last 12 months. But this isn't some Cold War John Bolton legacy issue. This is today, and it's urgent, and we need to address it, and we can't keep crossing our fingers and closing our eyes.
Yeah, and of course you mentioned the uranium sales to India. When it was mentioned that in order to reach the level we've talked about, or the government's talked about in the deal with India, we're actually going to have to open up new uranium mines to make it even worse.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm looking at the, you know, the Germans have this great saying, no trader cries out bad fish. The uranium miners always say, you know, we'll sell more, that we'll have more mines. The Mining Council, the Mineral Council of Australia, slavishly into uranium, despite its reasonably insignificant contribution to the GDP. I don't think we'll see a new boom. We'll see a new speculative boom as people use the headlines and junior companies use the headlines to mine the market more than the mineral. But I think it's probably, if there is to be extra sales to India, there's probably sufficient capacity in existing projects to deal with that. I'm not sure that there will be massive extra sales to India. We've had an agreement for over a decade and we've not sold a whole lot of uranium. I think there's a lot of spin in this. But there is a real threat as well. And you're right, uranium mining has a real and adverse impact. And no mine has ever been properly cleaned up. And the closest we've got is happening now, the Ranger mine in Kakadu, due to the sterling efforts of the Mirarr people. And that's costing $2.4 billion. And that's Rio Tinto, mm-hmm. who've got deep pockets and deep exposure to reputational risk. So, the junior companies don't. They have post office box numbers. So you don't want to let them loose because they just rip, ship and disappear. So you've got to be really careful and cap this industry. It's not a good one. But I think, the provision of uranium is a really serious thing. First and foremost, straight up, if you've got nuclear weapons, you don't get Australian uranium. That because it either can fuel or it can enable domestic supply to be used for weapons. There's no distinction once you've got nuclear weapons. So we shouldn't sell to any of those nuclear weapon states, and we do. That would be an easy, principled, effective, and it would signal that Australia is actually serious about this stuff rather than having little nuances of word games to give the appearance of responsibility.
And just to finish up, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but the ALP conference managed not to have any sort of debate around AUKUS, and yet there were lots of Labor luminaries who have given evidence to the inquiry into it, and yet their voices weren't heard at the conference, apparently.
No, there was a lot of work done to ensure that AUKUS, like a submarine, remained under the radar. And Labor was successful in doing that at conference. AUKUS didn't become like a big publicly debated thing. It was whispered. There's discontent, very significant discontent in the rank and file. 100 branches pre-conference calling on the Prime Minister to not just review, but to scrap AUKUS. So there's a lot of discontent. And this inquiry, the public inquiry that you referenced, that's going to be very interesting. In mid-August, I think around 11-12, it's in Sydney and Port Kembla. And then at the start of September, Kevin, it's in Canberra. And like you say, you know, there's a significant list of people who are engaging with this. You know, there's, you know, Gareth Evans and, you know, all sorts of others have come out and made comments. Bob Carr and many others, Doug Cameron.
And there was a wonderful article by Carmen Lawrence opposing the whole thing. She wrote a great article attacking the way it was all set up in the first place.
Yeah, well, Carmen's got a very, very thoughtful and very incisive assessment of this, and it makes a lot of sense. But also from the other side, like Christopher Pyne, Linda Reynolds, have both presented to this inquiry. And there's been some very interesting stuff exposed. And I think what this inquiry shows is that Labor can manage its own conference, but it can't manage people saying, why are we spending $33 million a day, every day till 2055 on nuclear submarines? Why are we throwing the keys to a new built base to American potentially nuclear armed submarine? What does this mean? There are real questions here that can't be just stage managed because of a promise of an appointment or a position, because people are actually asking. And I think this inquiry will hopefully crystallise calls for greater scrutiny and for greater transparency and lead to a parliamentary inquiry. But they're very concerned and they really want to suppress transparency on AUKUS. I mean, you can see that with Rex Patrick. Some people will know the former South Australian senator who's now like dog at a bone on FOI requests about where waste will go from AUKUS, so a growing concern, particularly for First Nations people. And the Commonwealth is threatening to hit him with massive legal fees, six-figure legal fees, if his FOI is rejected. Now, that is just an attempt to shrink civil debate of an issue of vast importance that has never had
unfortunately, but we'll talk to you again, even though you're retiring Friday from the current job. No doubt we'll be able to talk about this time and again because it's going to keep going. But thanks for your time this morning, Dave. It's been terrific.
No, thanks for the opportunity and great to talk in this role over the years, and look forward to more to come.
All right, well, good luck with your future too.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.